Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
You're tuned in to The Show on the Road, a music discovery podcast where I interview songwriters, band leaders, and artists from around the world. My name is Zach Lubitin. This month, The Show on the Road is sponsored by Winter Wondergrass, now with three unique festival locations. In Steamboat, Colorado, February 21st through 23rd, Lake Tahoe's beautiful Squaw Valley, California, March 27th through 29th, and now Stratton Resort, Vermont, for the second annual Sugar and Strings Fest, April 10th and 11th. Who throws a music festival under the stars in the middle of winter, you ask? Why, Winter Wondergrass, of course. These are the most unique festivals I've ever been a part of. I played them in Lake Tahoe and in Colorado, and you know what? Just because you're wearing snow pants doesn't mean you can't dance, and it is really, really fun, guys. Single and multi-day passes for Winter Wondergrass are available now. Head over to winterwondergrass.com for more. This week on the show, my conversation with a cerebral Texas-born roots rocker who has one foot in the torn tinsel of a Houston honky-tonk and another in a haunted California Black Mirror episode set in a tilted sci-fi future, who on one hand traffics in a deep-voiced country swagger, and on the other, isn't afraid to openly process his recent family traumas and loss on his stunning and aptly titled first solo album, Love in the Dark, Jason Hawk Harris. I want you to think about this for a second. When was the last time you really looked yourself in the mirror? I mean, took a long, deep look. You ever notice that we look much younger than our grandparents did at our age? Are we that better off? Are we happier, healthier people than they were? Of course, many factors are at play. Maybe it was the fact that folks like my grandmother would smoke 3 packs a day in their parlors without blinking and live to tell you about it. Or maybe we don't work on those hot, cacophonous factory floors like my grandfather did for decades. We don't pickle ourselves with 3 martini lunches. The fact is, when my grandmothers were looking at themselves in the mirror, they were barely getting by during the Great Depression. If there was one fact of life, it was that death was lurking around every corner and it decimated some part of every family. In many ways, I count my family to be extremely blessed. And yet, when I look back at their history, there's trauma and pain all around. On one side, my grandmother never knew her mother, losing her during childbirth, while my other grandmother lost her father when she was just 2 to pneumonia. And my dad's father, my grandfather, he gets a call when he's a teenager about his father who fell into the middle of a ship during his longshoreman's shift and never came back. And when I ask my grandmothers who were still going strong about how they dealt with all this, they laugh it off. This is just how things were. People died. And you moved on. You can't help but think that that pain is somewhere deep, deep inside them. And it changes us. It has to, right? And yet, we don't really think about it. We go to our office jobs or we sit in vans waiting to play songs each night, and you can see the lack of desperation, that bone-deep struggle and subtle separation from the pure survival on our faces. We're soft. We're young, even though we're growing old. Despite his youth and that cherubic face and bright boyish laugh that could place him anywhere between 16 and 35, Jason has that deep, world-weary wisdom that shines from his songs. They smell of the formaldehyde of funeral home waiting rooms and the sickly sweet stink of wilting tulips placed around the casket at some sad attempt at cheer. And sometimes that pain, that heartbreak, that loss of someone so close to you when you're still so young and need them so desperately, that can't be faked. And while most songwriters like myself like to hide behind walls of metaphor, on songs like Phantom Limb, Jason dives headlong into the trauma and tries to process it right there in front of us. And if one thing's clear, Jason has had to forge his own path through grief and addiction. And you know what? I'm glad he's on the path he's on, and that folks like the Outlaw Country Collectors at Bloodshot Records are giving him a fighting chance to put his music into the world. If this is the future of country music in America, sign me up. Before we jump headlong into the conversation with Jason here, I'd love to tell you real quick that my band Dust Bowl Revival's new record, Is It You, Is It Me?, is coming out January 31st. We're really excited to bring this to you guys. The tour starts next week, January 29th, at the Sinclair in Boston, and we're playing some wonderful venues on this first run, including the 930 Club in Washington, D.C., February 7th, the Paramount Theater in Bristol, Tennessee, February 8th, and we're going down to Asheville, North Carolina, Atlanta, cutting over to Nashville, where we're playing with the wonderful Front Country, who have been on this very show, February 12th, and we will head home to California to play some very big shows, February 28th at the Fillmore in San Francisco. Please come and see us and the wonderful Jared in the Mill from Arizona, and also February 29th at the Troubadour in LA. I can't wait to share some of this new music with you, and in a couple weeks we will talk to my gang, the Dust Bowl Revival, right here on the podcast. But that's enough of that. I would like you to sit down and relax, and please enjoy the conversation I had with the wonderful Jason Hawk Harris.
Grandfather, my mind is a blur. It's like I've been here a while, or I've just now arrived. And the water here's nice, and the wind is so fine. Have I been here a while, or did I just arrive? Grandfather, you have not said a word that is so unlike you. But it's clear from your smile, you know something so good. Something I don't know, but something I should. Oh, Grandfather, why haven't you said a word?
My name is Jason Hawk Harris, and you are the radio audience.
What would you describe your music as?
I usually come up with a jokey sort of thing to describe it as. Like, I've done Americana Griefgrass or Meta-Apocalyptic Country or something like that. But these days I just say country, Americana-ish.
And you're from Houston originally?
Yeah, originally from Houston. Mm-hmm.
Where'd you get the name Hawk? Where'd that come from?
It's my mom's maiden name.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I figure she had as much to do with me as my dad, whose name I have. My full name is his name. I'm a second.
Oh.
And so, but when my mom died, I didn't want that name to die, so.
So you're not going with the junior?
No, my parents did not want me to be called a junior. They were very adamant that they didn't want people knowing I was a junior and then calling me junior. They were just not into that. So they broke the rule. You're a junior if your dad is, if you're named after your dad. You're a second if you're named after your grandpa.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Uh-huh. You know, the griefgrass thing, mm-hmm. while we can chuckle about it now, I think is like, you know, comes from some real heavy stuff that's happened to you in the last, you know,
yeah.
few years.
Yeah, for
know?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're releasing this first solo record of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I just listened to it the last few days finally, and it's really intense, man. And it's big and it's fun, mm-hmm. but it's also like whiplash inducing in that, like, the honesty in which you get into some of the stuff, like your mom's death.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're not holding stuff back.
Right.
You know, which is like the poetry that can come from some of this real trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I think we expect it to be veiled like six layers deep sometimes. So
right.
it's like, well,
yeah.
we have to discover that, you know, your mom passed away.
Yeah.
And, you know, the alcoholism that is running through your family.
Yeah.
And you're right out with it. Like, there's not a lot of fear in your songs.
Well, I've often tried to be the other way yeah. that you describe.
Yeah.
Where it's like, because I love reading Neil Gaiman, because he releases bits of the story to you in such like
right.
vague and like veiled detail until finally you're at the end and like you feel like you have he's never come out and said it, but you know everything that's going on. And so I always want to do that. I always shoot for that. But I think during that time when I was going through such like intense grief, I just couldn't be anything but matter of fact with myself. And I have no clue if the rest of my writing will end up being like that down the line, but it certainly was for this record.
And the record's called Love and the Dark mm-hmm. on Bloodshot Records. Chicago's finest.
Mm-hmm.
Love Bloodshot.
Awesome. Yeah, they're great. I've been really happy with working with them so far.
And I think that the thing that surprised me going through these songs was the almost Elton John pop lushness to it.
Because
there's a lot of like piano.
Yeah, I love piano.
That's sort of running through the record. Mm-hmm. And these sort of big, almost musical theater tapestries going mm-hmm. on. You know, I think you're a big Queen fan as
well. Huge Queen fan.
You know,
absolutely.
You have a Spotify playlist of some of your favorite tunes. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I've never heard that Millionaire Waltz that you had on there.
Oh yeah.
The Queen song.
That's a great song.
And I'm like, what is this song?
It's bizarre.
You know?
It's one of my favorites of theirs, and I feel like it's a deep cut that people just don't know. They usually don't know that song.
It is kind of shameful how little I ever like look into some of Queen's other music.
Their back catalog is nuts.
Yeah, it's like, because it has this orchestral classical skewering, which I think you're doing too. Like you have strings and you have harmonies, but it's all sort of with a wink and a nod in a way. Like you're not trying to be too pretty about it.
I think I've more embraced like having a bunch of different instruments on a track versus like Brian May was like, nah, I want to do it all with the guitar, which is why he's such a genius.
Right.
You know, I mean, he made like, I think of the section of Take My Breath Away. Like this, he's got this orchestral session. He comes in with this guitar, and it sounds like a fucking cello. Language. Is there a language thing on this?
Please, no. Okay, go on. Go for it.
But I think that Queen definitely has had a huge effect on me in that regard, and just like the tapestry kind of way of thinking. I can't help it at this point. And when I was with the band that I was in before this, the Show Ponies, I would constantly try to input stuff like that. And everybody would kind of be like, chill out. That is not what this is.
Well, there's
which
always,
is true.
There's always a bit of the fear of creating something that you can't actually ever play live.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm going through the same thing with the new Dust Bowl record where I'm like,
right,
we need like a symphony orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
To play this right.
Yeah.
And is it going to be sort of a dumbed down, half-assed version when we play it in a bar somewhere? Mm-hmm. But sometimes you got to go in the studio and create the
just
magic in there. Like, why not?
Yeah.
You know, you're not doing a live record.
Yeah.
You're doing a studio record.
Yeah. And like live records are live records for a reason. I mean, people want that, you know, matter of fact, simplicity. They want to hear that. And then I think that, you know, what was cool about coming back to Queen again, and even Elton John, like, they went into the studio and were just like, we're just going to make it sound really cool on speakers.
Yeah.
And, like, we don't have any limits. We'll figure out the performance later. And it almost always works out, I've found. Like, even if you do something insane, like, I have a song on the record that I'll never be able to perform properly live unless, like, I'm making, you know, $40,000 a gig and I can bring an orchestra on the road with me.
Which one?
Grandfather. Hmm. It's the last one. At the end of it, there's like a huge string section and there's like xylophones, you know, and concert percussion and like stuff I'm just
some
not
timpani.
Gonna. Yeah, some timpani. Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff in there and it's just, I'm not gonna ever be able to do. I mean, my dream, don't get me wrong, is to do like a Lyle Lovett and his large band thing where I can like travel with like a, you know, 25-piece orchestra. I'd love to do that, but I mean, I realize that with the kind of music I write, I'm not going to be playing the Rose Bowl anytime soon or have that kind of budget.
You never know, but, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because the first single you released, Cursing at the Light, has this sort of upbeat, almost rockabilly, mm-hmm. you know, let's get drunk and screw everything else.
Yeah.
Which I was like, oh, well, the rest of the record will probably be like this.
Yeah, I wanted to ease people in.
And I go back and forth, especially with my stuff, of like, do we give them the happy or do we mm-hmm. give them the darkness?
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to know what's not going to scare people away, yeah, but also sure. what's going to make people take you seriously.
And also yeah. what's going to make people not like be like, whoa, 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 this is not what I signed up for when you give them the rest of it.
Yeah.
But, which is that I'm a little worried about, but yeah.
Well, you have that line, medicating that beat down heart of mine, mm-hmm. you know, in Cursing the Light. So you can finally sleep and
right.
you know, so do you have insomnia? My question is, and what do you do if you can't fall asleep?
Oh, I definitely have insomnia. I have it in bouts. Like I'll have, it happens less these days because I've never had much structure in my life. Like I've always just got up and be like, what am I going to do today? I'll do, you know? And so I've found that like one thing that has really helped my insomnia is like doing the same thing every morning. Like getting
what is
up,
that thing?
I get up, I make the bed, I go to the gym, I just totally like slog my way through it. I get home, I put some running clothes on and go for a run.
You go to the gym and then you go for a run?
Yeah, lately. And I've been doing this for like 3 weeks, but I have slept like a baby just from having like a routine. So like that's what I've been doing lately. But in the past, when I was more unhealthy, you know, I'd have a beer or like I'd stay up so late until
you got
I just...
a beer in the morning?
No. I mean like at night, like oh, yeah, if yeah. I wanted to get to sleep.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd have a beer or two or three or four. Or like I'd just wait or just until I passed out. Or I would go to like a show and stay out so late and like
right.
just wait until that moment where I had no other choice but to fall asleep.
Right.
You know, and then I'd feel guilty waking up at like 10.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, the whole day would be ruined and then the cycle starts again, you know.
It is funny how like when you wake up really early and you actually have to do stuff,
mm-hmm.
you can do all these things and it's like 10 a.m. and you're
yeah.
like, wait, the whole rest of the day is still available?
Yeah, man.
You know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It does feel great.
I'm yeah. not a morning person at all.
Okay.
But like, yeah, I can see how every now and again when you do that,
uh-huh.
like you feel really accomplished.
Totally, you know? Yeah. Like they say, you know, what is it? The Marines are like, the Marines get more done before 5 a.m. than anybody on the planet.
Yeah.
Like, cause they also probably go to bed at like 7:30, yeah. which is crazy. But I'm a morning person and a night person. So I'm like constantly warring with myself because I want to stay up late, but I also want to get up at like 6:30 a.m.
What is your relationship to alcohol now?
So I have a lot of the songs about alcoholism are like me trying to understand my mother's alcoholism
mm-hmm.
because while I have addictions, I've had legitimate addictions. Like alcoholism I've kind of was always terrified of because my mom and just seeing what it turned her into. And so I think a lot of these songs like Giving In, Cussing at the Light, where I'm like speaking as the alcoholic, I feel like it feels real to me singing it in one way because I am an addict, but in the other, but it feels strange in another way because it's not alcoholism that's my thing. So like you have those two songs that are totally from the alcoholic's perspective. As well, like as for my mom died, I just wanted to kind of like understand the thing that she needed so badly that she killed herself doing it, you know? And so I just found myself, it was really easy for me to slip into that mode of writing like an alcoholic, and this is kind of if I do say so myself moment, but if I do say so myself, I think it is believable, you know, even though I'm not an alcoholic. And I think it's just because you know, when someone dies, I just feel like you think of scenes, you think of things that happened with them that like all of a sudden you have this like insane amount of empathy. You can just yeah. kind of put those clothes on.
Well, and it's part of it is, you know, there's other songs on the record, Phantom Limb, you know, about the, you know, the formaldehyde, the tobacco and the tulips.
Mm-hmm.
It's never going to come out, that sort
right.
of smell, that feeling,
yeah.
you know, and you're not shying away from it. You're saying again and again, you know, mother, you're dead,
mm-hmm.
like you're gone.
Right.
And you know, this album is almost like a processing of that for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, for
know?
Sure. For
and,
sure.
You know, I wonder if you feel that there is a bit of a squeamishness in trafficking in your own pain.
Yeah, you know? I have felt that before. Like, I've felt like...
But also, like, why not try to process it through songwriting? That's what you do.
I mean, that's, like, the best thing I could do for myself.
But the commerce, the commerce of it is always uncomfortable to me.
Feels
it's
weird.
Like,
yeah.
Well, it's natural, but it's also like, please buy this product.
So I can keep doing it.
So I can process my mother's demise.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's tricky, you know?
Yeah, it is. And I think that for me, I've just had to continue to, because I think there is a tendency, there's this poem by Mary Oliver, who I think is like one of the greatest American living poet, or American poets ever, not living anymore, died recently, but she has this poem called The Poet With His Face in His Hands.
Mm.
And it's all, there's like one line in it that's like, you want to scream your problems out to the whole world so that everyone can hear, but the world already has enough of that noise.
Mm.
And then basically the end of the poem is just like, calm down and listen to the birds, you know? And I think that there is, in a sense, I feel like I am that guy with his face in his hands sometimes. Like, and I think for me, the way that I've tried to like combat against that tendency to kind of like wallow in the pain, because it is very cathartic to feel your pain, you know, but I think just like also looking and like continuing to like try to self-improve, you know, to not, you know, eventually I for my next record, I'm not going to talk about my mother's death. I've already decided.
You don't know that.
You're totally right. I don't know that, but like, it's
but you won't.
I'm at least
that's not
gonna
be the focus.
It's not gonna be the focus. Yeah. If I do something, it'll be, you know, a line here, like a song here. But you know, and not to say I couldn't keep processing this, because I can, and like maybe 5 years from now I'll do it, because like I think Carrie-Anne Lowell, isn't that about his mother dying? Like Sufjan Stevens, I think it is, but he wrote it like a while after, and like there's this other. Man, I sound really pretentious quoting poets, but there's Wordsworth who also said, like, poetry is memory properly remembered. And, like, so almost like you need some distance. Like, Phantom Limb was written the week after my mom died. Like, I don't even remember writing it. It just happened. Like, it just fell out of me, you know? And,
give me the first verse of Phantom Limb.
You want me to sing it?
No. No, just speak.
Okay, I got this shirt, smells like the viewing. Formaldehyde, tobacco, and tulips. I watched it 10 times and it won't come out. No matter how long it's been, I can't forget. I smell it right now and it won't come out.
Yeah. Yeah, that processing takes time, you know? And that's something that I think is so universal but so powerful for people. They need almost like your processing to give them permission to process things.
Yeah, I've certainly done that with other artists for sure.
I'm curious, when you're writing songs, do you feel like the imagination and the fantasy type of writing is important to you, or do you feel like writing about your actual experience is more how you do it, usually?
I think I don't have the energy to go through that kind of trauma all the time and write about it. Like, I think that I'm doing it right now just because it's there, but, like, you know, I think that it's just exhausting to do that when it's really, really happening. It's almost, I would actually argue that you've got more of a chance of capturing the feeling in the immediate by imagining that happening to your, to your lady. Like, you've got, you know, because it's, it didn't actually happen. So you have the perspective of real life to be living in. While you're looking at that situation and like looking at it from a fantasy point of view. Fantasy is a weird word for it, right? There needs to be another word for like that has to do with like a bad thing. Because when you hear fantasies, I always think of like sexual fantasies, which is like, but I mean, that's what it is, but
a projection
is great. I mean, you're scared of losing her, you're terrified, and that's, and maybe you're getting to the heart of it, is like you have all these people out here that like are terrible at just like recognizing that there's pain and death and fear and sadness in the world, and like maybe like writing a song like that gives them permission to feel that. And maybe homeboy with the beard who was crying on his couch with his wife, they're like, maybe, you know, he needs that song to be able to get into. But in regards to your question, I don't know. I just know that the one is exhausting.
Yeah.
And that the other, I don't think, I'm not with this whole like country music philosophy that's like, you got to write the truth, you know, about yourself. Because like, you can't, like, you just, no one's life is that interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few that maybe go against that, but
like, I got up and went to the gym.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no one's gonna write about that bullshit. Exactly.
Yeah. You know what? Because people need more poetry in their lives, uh-huh. We're gonna force feed it to them.
Let's do it.
You to read that Mary Oliver poem,
the poet
with his face in his hands.
Let's do it. All right. You want to cry aloud for your mistakes, but to tell the truth, the world doesn't need any more of that sound. So if you're going to do it and can't stop yourself, if your pretty mouth can't hold it in, at least go by yourself across the 40 fields and the 40 dark inclines of rocks and water to the place where the falls are flinging out their white sheets like crazy. And there's a cave behind all that jubilation and water fun, and you can stand there under it and roar all you want and nothing will be disturbed. You can drip with despair all afternoon and still on a green branch, its wings just lightly touched by the passing foil of the water, the thrush, puffing out its spotted breast, will sing of the perfect stone-hard beauty of everything.
Stone-hard beauty of everything.
Mm.
That's good, man.
Yeah, she's great.
Rest in peace.
Absolutely. She is.
Yeah, so, you know, the line in Giving In, I wish that where I am is where I've been. I was trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the Bob Dylan, I was so much older then, younger than that now.
You got to do a little time warp.
What do you mean by that?
So I wish that where I am right now, which is alcoholic, drunk, like totally rock bottom,
right,
was where I've been. So that I could be looking back in this part of my life.
Yeah.
So that's...
Like, I wish I was already past it, but I'm
not. Yeah, but I'm not. Yeah.
Yeah, the other line that, you know, I have a wife that works hard and I spend her money in the dark, you know. There is the kind of... the predicament that a lot of touring musicians have where the wives are making the real money.
Yeah.
Or like... are they actual breadwinners and responsible people in the family?
Uh-huh.
And obviously they love you for your talent.
For sure.
But...
yeah, that might have been how you got them to marry you.
It comes to a point where you're like, is this a smart move that you did in marrying me?
Yeah. No, I've been experiencing that a lot lately. I mean, since the band that I was in stopped, you know, touring, I mean, I've been hustling just to try to make anything.
Yeah.
And I think that, it's also like with male musicians, not that it's not, you know, a particular predicament with female musicians as well, but like I feel with male musicians, like societal pressures, especially from where I'm from in Texas, where it's like the man makes the money, you know, it's like there's still this like kind of like, I don't know, this evolutionary kind of thing inside of me that's like, I need to kill.
Well, it's like a shame thing. And bring it home. Like,
yeah, it's a shame thing. Why
hasn't my talent been recognized in a monetary way?
Yeah. And also, it's a shame thing because it's like, I can't, you know, and this is a hang up, but it's like, oh, I can't provide for my wife kind of thing, which, I mean, she doesn't need me. She does not need me, you know. I mean, she does great, you know.
How long you guys been together?
Together, whoa, 12 years.
Wow.
And we've been married for 8.
Mm-hmm. Impressive. Yeah. 8? You don't seem that old.
I'm 31, but we got married young. We got married 23.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you were in L.A. already, or was that...
Yeah, I was in L.A. So we both grew up together in Houston. She...
Are you high school sweethearts?
No, definitely not. It was complicated. But she went to Baylor in Texas and I went out here and then we were long distance for like 4 years and then she moved out here to LA and we've been here ever since and we got married when she moved out here.
Staying together long distance is not easy.
It was like, don't get me wrong, it was brutal, but like at the same time I think like I have this kind of like when you know, you know. Like, yeah. We both knew we were going to marry each other. It was just set. Like, we were just, we never had any doubts about it. We were just crazy about each other.
Where'd you meet?
We met at a tween dance club.
Okay.
That was in my hometown. It was called Attitudes.
Ooh.
It was weird, man. Like, there was some weird shit going on.
Attitudes.
Like, you had these people that were running it that were like, you know.
Is it a Christian kind
of
thing?
No, not at all. The people that were running it were like basically training us to go clubbing. Mm. And like, they would, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened. Like, in this Christian conservative community, like, this guy would get on stage, this older guy that like owned the place. He's like 45, 50, something like that. And he's like, all right, let's get all the girls on stage and see who shakes with their mom and gave them the best. And all these like 13, 14-year-old girls would get up on stage just like twerking. And like, I go back now and I think about that and I'm just like, whoa.
Yeah.
What was that place? And now it's like, I think they figured out what was going on because now it's literally, it's not just gone, but it's demolished.
Yeah.
The building and everything. But yeah, it was weird, man. But anyways, we met there.
Did you ask her to dance?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it was, yeah, oh, that was such a weird place.
Were you a melodramatic rock and roll 13-year-old?
I was, yeah. I am one of those melodramatic fools. Yeah. As Green Day, as Billy Joe Armstrong said, I sang Basket Case for my 8th grade talent show. So, you know, you're absolutely right. I was melodramatic.
I sang the Ramones' Sedated.
Oh, hell yeah. I want to be sedated. Absolutely.
And the music teacher, who was from Austria,
mm-hmm.
pulled the electricity
because
it was too loud.
That's so punk, man. You kept playing, right?
And the crowd was like, no, like, let them play.
Yeah.
And the funny thing was that my dad was the MC
uh-huh.
of the talent show. And he was like, okay, let's let's get them off stage. And I was, he like totally like threw me under the bus. He's yeah. like, well, that was a little much. Here's some tap dancing.
Oh my gosh, that's so good. Have you like gone to therapy for that?
I think I thought it was kind of like amusing at the time.
Yeah.
It made us look cooler, I think.
Oh, for sure. You know, it made it more punk.
Like
for
Miss
sure.
Swisher was like not having it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And Miss Swisher was the man.
Yeah.
I mean, at
she
that
was.
Point. Yeah.
What was the first band that you played in?
That I played in? It was a band called Payday. Fifth grade. But like we had these my sister has a form of cerebral palsy, so she always had these she couldn't ride a regular bike. Mm. So she had these like tricycles, these big adult tricycles, and they had big baskets on them. And so like to have band practice, we would like fill that basket like with our amps and stuff and just ride to each other's house. And I remember we just had like we were just like this troop of like three-wheeled bikes like going around the neighborhood with our gear. But that's my best memory from that time.
There is something uniquely exciting about when you first form a band.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, we're going to take over the world.
Yeah. And you have all that hope and that optimism.
And you're like, we can actually play
yeah.
the same notes as each other.
Yeah,
and
we can do
sounds
this.
Sounds raw, nasty, and
yeah.
awesome.
I yeah. mean, that first time that you play, like, I remember playing with someone with two electric guitars and both strumming like an A chord.
Yeah.
And like
it's
being
intoxicating.
Like being like, my dad taught me you can play an A chord here.
Yeah.
And I can play an A chord here.
Yeah.
And playing that at the same time and just being like, we're basically like pros.
Did your dad teach you guitar?
Yeah, he did. Mm-hmm.
Did he play?
Yeah, he plays and sings. He sounds like James Taylor. Mm. That's kind of his wheelhouse. And I just, me and my stepmom or my stepmom just got him a guitar, a Martin, and he hadn't been playing for a while, and so he started to play again. So happy about that. But yeah, he was a worship leader at the local church, and like so I was exposed to him singing and playing, you know, from a young age, and I wanted to do it too. So
what is your relationship with your dad now?
That's great. My dad's like my best buddy. He's young. So I'm 31. He was 18 when I was born.
Oh, wow.
So he's 50. And so, like, you know, he looks really young. When we hang out, people think we're like brothers,
yeah.
even. So it's a unique relationship. But yeah, we're super tight. We're best buds. My relationship with my mom was much more complicated, but with him, it's always been easy.
And when did you come out here? When in college?
Yeah, I came out here like 13 years ago. Yeah, so when I was 18 for college. Went to Biola University, small school down in Orange County, small liberal arts university, but went to the conservatory there.
Because you have definitely some classical leanings in some of your songs.
But that's what I studied in school, was classical composition is what I did.
On guitar?
No, I studied pencil and paper
writing
stuff. Like, I was really into orchestral writing, so yeah.
If you could write the score to any movie that has already come out that you love, what would it be?
Ooh, what a great question. This is interesting because part of me wants to go to like my favorite scores in movies, but then I'm like, well, wait, I don't want to redo that though. Yeah. But then the other part of me like wants to go to movies that like I think the score could have been like better or I didn't like it very much. One such instance of that, I think the latter is, what's the movie with Kevin Costner and they're looking for the mobsters?
Untouchables?
The Untouchables. I think that's the worst movie score ever.
Okay.
For a decent movie, you know? So I'd pick that one. It's bizarre. Do you remember it at all? Does it come to mind?
It's been a while since I've seen it. All I remember when I was a kid, I watched it in high school. We watched it because our high school drama teacher is in the movie as an actor.
Nice.
It was like her moment of Chicago of fame.
Yeah, gotcha.
She played like a woman coming in and reporting a crime or something.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
All right, so The Untouchables.
The score is bizarre.
Okay, so redo that.
But if I, how about a score that I wish I would have written?
Okay.
The Red Violin, John Corigliano, is the most beautiful and impressive score I've ever heard because it basically, have you seen the movie?
Think so, yeah.
Yeah, so it follows the life of this violin that was made in like the 14th or the 15th century,
right,
and up all the way into the present time. And so you see this era, this violin going through all these different eras, and like so he's writing music for that period of each era that the violin goes through. So he starts in like the Renaissance and he's writing, you know, like Monteverdi,
right,
and then he goes to like the 17th century where he's writing like Bach, and then he's able to do it masterfully, and then he's got this like character and he's like a Paganini, so he's like writing romantic music, and then goes in the early 20th century with like Stravinsky and stuff. It's more modern, and then like you get all the way to the Chinese Revolution, where they're trying to protect this thing. And,
I don't
like,
think I have seen this movie. I should rent it.
It's amazing, just because they have this like the violin becomes a character. And it's a great movie, but the score is, it won the Oscar for best score that year. But yeah,
what do you think is the most transcendent musical experience that you've had in your life, like a concert or a moment that sticks in your brain?
I think the one that changed my life the most, when I was in fifth grade, I had only up to that point been exposed to like Christian contemporary music. And like, so that was what I listened to. And
no classic rock being
actually
around the house.
Country. Yeah. I had been exposed to a lot of country and like Roy Orbison and Elvis. But like anything written past like the 1980 needed to be like Christian music. And my parents totally, like, once I turned like 12, they were like, all right, there's all this other stuff too. But I guess I don't know why. They just wanted me to listen to that stuff when I was younger. But I was over at a friend's house. A heathen friend's house who had a Queen record and he played Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
And that was the first like time I had heard like anything like that. And my world just like opened up. It was amazing. I wish it was like a concert or something, but it wasn't. It was in this like dingy little bedroom that smelled like sweaty boy.
Yeah.
You know, and playing this like Bohemian Rhapsody on his big old speakers. Like,
probably sounded like music from outer space.
Yeah. But out of his Pentium 2 processor.
Yeah.
I actually just remembered one from a concert experience that I completely forgot about. Do you know the band Saves the Day?
That sounds, yeah.
Like, they're not, they're a love 'em or hate 'em band because this dude has this really emo, like nasally voice.
Right.
But if you like really look at it, the songwriting's killer. And they have this one song called This Is Not an Exit. And I was at the Verizon Theater in Houston, Texas. And I was like 17. And I was miserable because my girlfriend at the time had just broken up with me and started dating my best friend.
Oof.
And like I hear, and like I was just like, you know, so upset. And I think I was 16 actually. Yeah, the band came out and they played this song called "This Is Not an Exit." Mm-hmm. And the words of the chorus are like, just sail belly up to the clouds, the rocks scraping your backs, to breathe in the air will be the only thing that you have. And it's this really uplifting song about like, hey, yes, it's painful, just like float.
Yeah.
You know, just float, because you're not going to get away from it. And like, it was this moment where I had tears rolling down my cheeks. Mm. I mean, that was really impactful.
It was like just for you in that moment.
Exactly, man. It really felt like that. Taking Back Sunday played before, they were terrible.
So, I mean, you're in a place right now, you know, you're releasing your first record. It's exciting, but it's also like you're starting over in a way.
Oh,
right?
Totally. Yeah.
So like you have to get out there and you have to make a name for yourself mm-hmm. from scratch.
Yeah.
You know, is that both daunting and exciting, or like what are you feeling about it right
now?
It
would have been way more daunting had Bloodshot not come around and said, we're going to take a flyer on this kid. It would have been way, way more daunting. I don't even know. Like, I was at a point before I signed with Bloodshot where I was like, you know, because the Show Ponies, we worked our butts off to, like, really, Show Ponies band I was in before, we worked our butts off to kind of get out there and get on tour. And, like, we did, like, you know, 6, 7, 8 really, really low-paying tours, you know, before we finally got some, like, traction. And we booked most of those tours ourselves. And then we finally got on Crossover Prater Day at the time. I think you guys were on there too. And like, that was a huge relief. And like, but that time of like working our butts off to like make right. that whole thing work, you know, that was a lot of energy.
Yeah.
And I was just talking to Clay, the lead singer in that band, the other day. And we were talking to like, I think you have that kind of energy to start something like that one time.
Yeah.
Like once.
Well, it helps being young and kind of stupid.
Exactly.
Because you're
yeah.
just like, we're going to
yeah.
spread our seed Devil all over care. America.
This is a hilarious yeah. way to put it. Yeah.
No, but eventually, you know, you guys were selling out the Troubadour and stuff like that.
Yeah,
you know?
No, we had great things going. Yeah.
But I think like there comes a point where the scary realization is like, is this as far as this is going to go?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I feel that about my band a lot of times where right. it's like, yeah, we can like, we headline the Fillmore,
mm-hmm.
but like,
no easy feat.
I don't see how right now there's going to be anything bigger than that unless something else magical happens.
Right.
And that's a scary place to be because you're like, we are busting our ass all over America.
Absolutely.
And people love what we're doing, but not like enough
yeah.
to make a difference.
Do you think that's what it is? Do you think it's not enough? Or do you think you're just at a point where
our
like...
music is not maybe interesting enough on a national scale, or our story is not cool enough?
I see what you mean.
Because sometimes, honestly, and my wife works, you know, at NPR, it's like the story counts,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
You know, and your story about coming through hardship and, you know, alcoholism and trauma, it's uncomfortable because it's like, well, this is what I'm selling.
Mm-hmm.
But also, people like buying that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times, if I'm real about it, what story do I have?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I have that I'm a songwriter and I'm a playwright and I moved out here from Chicago and I put an ad on Craigslist and that's our story.
Right.
You know? Which is fine.
Yeah.
But like there's people I've had on this show, the Warren Treaty, for example, right?
Right. Oh my gosh.
But those guys,
oh
I mean, you could
gosh,
make a
yeah.
movie out of
Absolutely.
Their story.
Absolutely. Today.
I mean, he's like, you know, he's a Iraq war veteran. He's writing songs on the pianos in Saddam Hussein's palace, you know? And, I mean, like they...
That's a hell of a story.
I mean, it's yeah. it's just like...
I see what you mean. It's,
right?
It's sensational.
But that's why I think sometimes I appreciate guys like Bob Dylan,
mm-hmm.
who... He didn't have a story.
No.
Right?
Uh-uh.
He made it all up.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that is part of the American sort of roots tradition in a way, is that if you don't have a story, make your own
story. Yeah, make your own story.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's a scary thing where you're like, maybe I'm not interesting enough.
Yeah, you know? Man, I totally see what you're saying. And it's a shame because like we have this sort of, My wife was saying this the other day. We were talking about Blink-182.
Yeah.
And how, like, Tom DeLonge is no longer in Blink-182. And do you remember this, like, project he came out with called Boxcar Racer?
Maybe.
It was, like, it was a different thing. He was trying to be serious.
Right.
And, like, people... I'm saying this is the downside to being interesting as a musician, or like having an interesting story, is that like these guys were known as like these dudes that joked about like spreading peanut butter on their balls and letting their dogs lick it off. Like that was their thing. That was like their, that was their story. I mean, essentially. And like at some point Tom DeLonge gets to like age like 26 or 27. He's like, I kind of want to be taken seriously. And the people that were fans of them just would not let them be taken seriously. They were just like, no, this is what you are to us now, and you have to stay this way.
Yeah.
Because this is why we came on board in the first place.
Right.
And now they're all in, like, music purgatory. Because, like, the new Blink-182 stuff is all trying to be more serious and, like, more, you know. And it's not bad, you know. But, and then Tom DeLonge doesn't even want to be part of Blink-182. He's doing his own thing that's, like, trying to be more serious and everything. But it's, like, they're not letting them do that. So sometimes I wonder if, like, you know, if Perfume Genius comes out with a record where he doesn't necessarily just want to, like, you know, because his first two records are very much about his experience as a gay man, you know? Like, what if he comes out with a record like, this is not about that? Like, are people going to be okay with that?
Yeah.
Or, like, somebody else, you know? Because, like, people are such consumers. They're like, no, you need to be this for me. And I haven't done as much touring as you have, but with the touring that I have done, I'm just doing the same thing every night and, like, you know... Like, there's so many... I mean, there are still times when I play... With the show point is when we played these songs, like, hundreds of times. Like, there would still be a moment every now and then where we'd play a song we'd played so many times, and I'd be like, I love this right now.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I love it right now.
Well, sometimes if a crowd is really feeling one song...
And like, that's the novelty, right?
You're like, oh, my God, this song is great.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And then you play it, like, crap tomorrow, and you're like... Should we be playing this song anymore?
Yeah.
Do you remember a particularly gnarly venue that you played that you feared for your life and limb? Or you, like, wanted to get out of there as quick as possible?
Yeah. There's this place called... It's on the way to Phoenix near Blythe. And it's called, like, the Redwood... What is it called? The Red Roof Inn or something like that.
Live at the Red Roof Inn.
Yeah, some shit like that. And we... First of all, we had this sweet kid playing piano and singing opening for us. And so he opened the show, and he's open to a bunch of people that do not give a shit about anything he's doing. It's just him and a piano. And
the
he played.
Sail In?
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you remember that play? Is that what
it's
called?
Yeah, I do remember that.
That was also one of my least favorite
shows. It was a little like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's this like all the walls are concrete. Everything's concrete. Yeah. Weirdest thing. It looked like a Soviet bloc bar.
Yeah.
But anyways, he played and like we're feeling really pretty bad for him, and then we get on stage and like we have more energy or whatever, and this is when all the drunk people come out and we start playing songs and playing some covers, and it was just a gig. It was like $100. It was very early on. I think it was like our second tour ever, and we start playing, and then in the middle of our set this drunk ass white lady just comes up to us, and she's like she wants to sing.
Okay.
And she's like, I want to sing a song. I want to do it. I'm going to, I need you to, do you know any like black girl shit?
Oh my God.
Like Adele? And,
wow.
Yeah. And and she just got on stage and she grabbed a mic and she started trying to sing. And like, we all just were like, okay, let's take a break. And so we all get off the stage and there's a security guy there.
Yeah.
We're like, hey man, I know you don't usually expect to do this kind of shit for the bands here, but can you get this crazy lady off stage?
Yeah.
And she was sloppy, nasty drunk. And we just had to keep, we had to play that set because we were like, they're paying us. And like the gigs we had played before that, that was not necessarily the case. Yeah.
That $100.
Yeah, that $100 is going to get us to Phoenix, which that's true. I mean, we did need it to get to Phoenix, but
What's the song that you think you've written that maybe is the most offensive or controversial that you can think of? Offensive to some people.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would be I'm Afraid, a song called I'm Afraid, that is basically, I had a friend who grew up in a Catholic household, and his mom, for protection, put this really scary picture of Jesus above his bed. Ooh. And so,
like demon Jesus?
No, no, just like one of those iconography Jesuses where he's got like his heart in his hand, and he's just like,
it's like,
you know,
dripping blood.
Yeah, exactly. And he said that when he was a kid, he wasn't afraid of monsters; he was afraid of Jesus. So I wrote a song about that, and I think the first verse is, "When I was young, I prayed that he would let me be mother." Mother hung his picture on my wall and prayed I would believe, and she'd kiss my sweaty forehead and turn out all the lights. No monster ever scared me like the face of Jesus Christ. I listened to the promises and came to the Lord, and I got pain and I got suffering and I don't know what for. When I talk to Jesus, I'm going to ask him to his face, why'd you make this shit so hard? Lord, it feels like I've been played. And I think some Christian folks are not really into approaching Jesus with such realistic emotions.
What were you afraid of most as a kid?
I had this fear that when I was a kid that there was going to be a hole just big enough to fit my bed that was going to open up.
Like a sinkhole?
No, like almost like a trap door. Oh. And the trap door would just open up and I would fall endlessly.
Wow.
And never stop.
Was it a dream?
No, I would wake up and have that legitimate fear. I didn't have a dream of that. But
where would that come from?
I have no idea, man.
Huh.
I mean, I did grow up Christian. There is some Christian trauma there. I would still kind of consider myself a Christian, but like there is like this whole, like in the South especially, I mean, they're very fond of hell. They're way more fond of hell than they are of being a Christian or being like, you know, talking about Jesus or talking about heaven. They're like, well, hell's real, son, and you're going to go there if you don't do, you know. It's, yeah. So I think there was probably that, you know, that as a kid I was just like, oh my gosh, I could go straight to hell.
And what do you think you're most afraid of now?
Most afraid of now? Ooh, those are some good questions. I think I'm most afraid of my wife dying. Like, if I lost my wife, I think I'd... I have multiple occasions, weekly, I think of that happening, and I... Ooh.
Well, I woke up in a daze and thought I was alone. And I looked to my right and saw an angel from the Lord. He was eating something when he smiled right at me. Picked me up like I weighed nothing, and I could not say a thing.
Do you think you have an abandonment issue from your mom?
Maybe, and I think also watching my dad go through losing a wife, that I think that exacerbated it a little bit. And, you know, just knowing how much she, you know, is a part of my life and how much she means to me, I don't know what I'd do without her.
What's the first song you wrote about your wife?
It's bad. I do not.
Exactly.
The first song I wrote about my wife was
after Attitudes and the Dance.
Yes, in 9th grade. And it was a song called, oh, golly. There's a song called There's Something About Ashley. And
is her name Ashley?
Yeah.
Wow, so it's just like not even hiding it.
Not even hiding it, yeah. And but, you know, that's how I've always kind of been. Just put it out there. And
what was the chorus?
I didn't have a chorus. It was a
There's something about Ashley.
It was a verse form. I don't think I ever actually said the phrase There's Something About Ashley. I can't even remember the melody, to be honest with you.
Did she ever hear it?
Yeah. And I think there is a recording of it.
Was she impressed?
Yes. And I wrote another song. I was super cheeseball in high school. Man. Okay. What scares me is some people have a recording of this song, and I do not want it to come out, so I'm not even going to say what it is. But it's cheese. Yeah, big bowl of cheese.
If you were to throw your own music festival, first 5 people you would book, and where would it be?
Okay.
Also can be dead or alive.
Okay, cool. Ooh, okay. I'm going to go 2 dead, because I feel like it'd be easy to go 5 dead here.
Right.
Okay, so Queen, Judy Sill.
Okay.
Easy. Queen, Judy Sill, Willie Nelson, Mitski.
Mitski.
And... oof. What is that? There's so many places I could go with this. Because I'm also trying to think of like a fun time, you know? St. Vincent.
Ooh, all right.
Yeah, those five. I like that variety.
In any, lot. And you can have it in any site. In
any
the world.
Site, any site. I would want to do it on, like, even if it's like physically impossible.
Sure.
Okay, Mount Waialae in Kauai.
Ooh,
it's always raining. It's like the most beautiful place on earth, but it's always raining.
I think I've been there.
Yeah.
Well, it's like that sign, the rainiest place on earth.
Yeah,
uh-huh,
yeah, yeah. The wettest place on earth, or yeah. something like that. It's like this. You get up there, and it's this valley of just like tinkling waterfalls, yeah. like all around you. It's
well, and I remember we were trying to take a picture, and the fog had yeah. just cleared on that like coastline of the mountains. We're like, oh my god, get your phone out!
Uh-huh.
And by the time we got our phones
fog's
out,
fog's right back in.
It was gone.
Yeah.
And you're like, no.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
If you could have dinner with any person in history, who would it be?
Maybe Moses. I feel like some crazy shit happened to Moses.
Kind of got a bad rap.
Yeah. Like, I want to know some... I want to know, like... Because he wrote... You know, like the Pentateuch, right?
Mm.
So
you know better than I.
I want to know, like, what
did the burning bush really say?
Yeah, like, or what part of like what part of this is like, you know, narrative, and what part of this like actually how? What part is historical?
Yeah, I love like Jesus to actually come back.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And just to like go to a mega church and be
yeah.
like,
oh,
this is
gosh.
Not what I meant.
Yeah, y'all are wrong. This is not it, man. This isn't it.
Dinner with Moses.
Yeah, dinner with Moses. Some pita bread. Some unleavened bread.
Dude, your beard is so in right now, man.
Yeah.
Where do you think you get your creative mind from?
I think my family in general is creative. I mean, I had my great uncle, my grandpa's brother was a songwriter who actually went into Sun Studios one time and was like, I got this song, I want to record it. And he went with my grandpa.
Wow.
My grandpa tells this story. And they were like, yeah, let's do it. And they recorded it. And then they were like, okay, well, this is a great song, man. Here's the contract. And my grandpa was like, the older brother was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Before we sign this contract, we're just going to go and like, you know, make sure there's not any other offers or anything.
Yeah.
Tried to big time Sun Studios wow. in like the early 60s.
Balls.
Yeah. That's one word for it. Anyway, so they...
hubris?
They, yeah, exactly. Hubris. And he would say the same thing, by the way. But they left. And then they came back a few days later once they didn't find any other offers. Go figure.
Yeah.
And they were like, hey, we're back. And the guy was like, I don't remember you guys. Bye. I just wonder how the trajectory of me of like yeah. my life...
Yeah.
Would have been different.
Maybe you wouldn't exist.
Yeah, maybe I wouldn't exist. Or maybe, like...
Could have been the next Johnny Cash.
Yeah, who knows? But, or his life, for that matter, because he ended up getting, you know, addicted to heroin and died of AIDS in, like, 1991.
Jesus.
And, like, you know, I just... Yeah, but he wrote songs, and they were good songs. He has this one song that's, like... Bought her a car, bought her a house, spent $10,000 on a chair and a couch, bought her fine food and imported tea... And I bought the shoes that just walked out on me.
Ooh.
And so he wrote some good
ones. Cover
that. Yeah, I have covered that. Yeah, but probably him and my granny, my grandma's mom had a show and had a radio show in Fredericksburg where people would in Fredericksburg, Texas, a little small German town. They would call in and ask her to play music on her piano, and she'd just do it. So
over the phone.
Over the phone. Yeah. Uh huh.
It's kind of amazing.
Somebody would ask from yeah. the phone, and then they would come and tell her, like, somebody wants you to play this, and then she would play it.
I really wish that they weren't weed whacking right outside the window right
oh,
now.
Oh, right, yeah.
Some uh-huh. heavy, like, landscaping
Some
happening.
Heavy weed whacking.
I mean, do you think that creativity on one hand, but also addiction on the other hand, is a genetic... through line, or is it something that is about choices?
Just scientifically, I believe 100% that there is an addiction gene for sure.
Yeah.
Anybody who's been through the program, you know, knows like that's like one of the first things, one of the first steps is to recognize that like this is a gene. There's a problem here. Yeah, I certainly believe that. The creative thing's more interesting to me. Just as a question of whether it's like, I think there's certainly some sort of innate nature to it, some sort of genetic nature to it, but I think there's also like some nurture there too, where you just, your life experiences like what you think is cool as a kid, like what you're into as a kid. I don't know. But I certainly think that addiction is genetic for sure.
What would you tell someone who's trying to remake themselves and trying to stay clean? Like, what is the way to do that that's actually practical?
I think that, you know, starting in the program is like the best thing you can do. It has the highest success rate of any.
AA?
Yeah, AA. It has the highest success rate of any program.
Well, just being around peers that are trying to mm-hmm. change themselves.
Yeah, but also, I mean, yeah, exactly. Being around that community of people who are like, you know, because being encouraged is such a huge part of like trying to change yourself, like having encouragement and like being built up by people around you. And if you're around like a bunch of negative energy, people doing stuff that you don't want to be doing, I mean, it's nigh impossible to get out of it.
We're going to do an exercise right now.
Let's do it.
With our friend William Shakespeare.
All right.
So I want you to think the first thing that comes to your mind from a moment in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a place, maybe it's a person, situation. When I say the following line. When everything seems double.
Oh, this is perfect. I have this like constant metaphor in my life of like, you know the myth of the doppelganger? Yeah. Like, we use the doppelganger as like this, like, oh, that's your doppelganger.
Right.
But like, it's actually like this German, for the listeners at home who don't know, it's this piece of German folklore.
Mm.
And it's a bad omen.
Mm.
And it's when you're walking down the street and you see yourself out of the corner of your eye. And you look, and then it's gone.
Mm.
And it's considered a bad omen.
Mm.
And there's this book by Charles Williams where he talks about like the idea of like approaching your doppelganger.
Mm.
Like, and just being like okay with it, you know?
Hmm.
And so, like, there's this moment where you just, like, you meet yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You say, oh, this is who I am, and I'm going to be okay with it.
Hmm.
So, like, at one point in my life, when I was in a cycle of addiction and, like, going through this kind of, like, process of figuring myself out, there was this constant fear of like anytime somebody asked me like, okay, this is something you need to dive into, like this thing that happened to you when you were a kid, like you need to dive into this, you need to understand it better if you want to get past this. And like, it's this terrifying thing because it's almost like you see yourself out of the corner of your eye and you thank God when you look over and you see that it's not there anymore,
because
to look it in the face would be terrifying. You know, so when you say, when I hear that line, that's what I go to. It's this myth of the doppelganger and like just approaching yourself and seeing yourself for who you are and seeing that this is something that you're, that's going to force you to like deal with your issues.
Wow. All right, here's the next one. As by your safety, wisdom, all things else, you mainly were stirred up.
Hmm. I thought of my mom. There was this youth group thing called UM Army, where we went out and fixed a bunch of houses for impoverished folks in Texas. And my mom was not a social person. She was very much an introvert and kind of had social anxiety. And the word safety made me think of this. She was like, one year she was like, I'm really committed this time. I'm going to go and be a part of this thing. Cause the parents would come too. That was the whole thing. Like, we would all get together and like go fix, you know, fix like siding or like, you know, make wheelchair ramps and stuff like that. And she was like, I'm going to do it this year. Cause she had never had, and she was sober at the time. And she came and just kind of got eaten alive by the soccer moms there.
She wasn't like the other moms.
No. Yeah. And she wanted to help, and she was a physician assistant. And so she was like, I'll be on the safety team, which there was like every morning they would like tell you, you know, where like watch out for like exposed nails and stuff like that. And if anybody had any injury, they'd come to them. And, she just got eaten alive by the other moms. Because she just wasn't like them, and she wasn't sociable, and she had this anxiety, and like people thought she was weird for it, and she had insomnia, so she could never sleep in a place that like wasn't her place. Mm. And then she, you know, she left 3 days early. And I don't know why, but that just always killed me.
Yeah. Well, it's like you want your mom to be, like, there for you.
Yeah, but I also felt bad for her.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I know she wanted to do so bad. Mm. And, yeah, it's just when she died, I started thinking about stuff like this.
Did she hear any of the songs on this record before she passed?
I actually got to play her the last song on the record, Grandfather, which references her dying.
Oof.
Weird thing for me. But, yeah.
How did she react?
We both cried like babies.
Wow.
My whole family was in the room. I wrote that song in like 20 minutes, and I came out and played it. I was like, I don't know where this came from, but...
Mm.
And, yeah, we just... I don't even think I finished the last line of the song before I was...
How's the chorus go in that?
So it's another, I'm a big fan of chorusless songs. It's another verse form song. So it's just like verse, 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 verse. But, the last line is, she's singing this song as she braids her black hair, free from death and destruction, decay and despair, peaceful and lovely and breathing new air.
Mm.
But yeah, that's,
you think she's in a happier place?
I definitely like, I'm a big believer in heaven. Absolutely. So yes, I do. But it's okay if other folks don't believe in an afterlife. I'm not interested in pushing that on anybody.
I appreciate that the weed whacker...
Stopped for that
moment about
Yeah, it's really tasteful.
He's really going at it.
Yeah, he sure is.
All right, last one. As I am an honest man, I thought you had received some bodily wound.
I'm going back to my mom again. We were in a car accident when I was 18, a pretty nasty one. We were going through this, there was an exit ramp. My mom was not the best driver. We were going to pick up a new car in another part of town that she had gotten. And there's this exit ramp and we're going pretty fast and she realizes this is the exit ramp she needs to go into, so she whips into it and starts fishtailing back and forth, and so much so that like she was perpendicular with the road at one point, at which point an 18-wheeler comes through and T-bones us. Oof. On the driver's side. If it would have been like 2 feet closer to the driver's side door, she would have been dead, but it hit behind. So I didn't have my seatbelt on and I'm like, you know, just like getting thrown around the car. She had her seatbelt on, but she, when I came to, you know, it's all fuzzy and I'm looking up and I turn to the left and I see her in the driver's seat and she's like just hanging, her head's just hanging there limp.
Oof.
And there's blood coming from her head.
Yeah.
And I thought she was dead. And I had blood coming down my face too. And like I got out of the car and I was like, does anybody have any towels? You know, I'm just freaking out. This kid, like, bleeding on his face and, like, getting, you know, somebody give me some towels. And, like, this, these lawn workers came up to me and they handed me some towels. And, like, so I put pressure on her, put pressure on mine. She finally woke up and she said, that fucker came out of nowhere. And my mom did not cuss very much.
Yeah.
But, which it didn't come out of nowhere at all. But, so we went to the hospital and, we're at Ben Taub, which is like this big, big, big hospital in the ER. And we both got these identical gashes on our foreheads.
Wow.
And they're open because they haven't had a chance to stitch us up yet. So we're just sitting around with these huge gashes on our forehead that are clotting. So they're not bleeding anymore. So we took this picture of us, just like a selfie before there were even selfies. Yeah. We had like a disposable camera.
Yeah.
And we took a picture of ourselves with identical forehead gashes. It's pretty gruesome, but that's what I thought of.
Be a good album cover someday. You know,
That is not the first time I've heard that or thought that.
Actually, wanted to ask you about the album cover for your upcoming record.
It's like a
cabin bursting into flame,
right?
Being lifted off the ground. Infested by some sort of many tentacled beast.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Kind of reminded me of Stranger Things a bit.
Yeah, it has a Stranger Things feel
to it. But also this sort of cozy home in the woods being just obliterated from all sides.
Yeah, love that.
Where's that image come from?
I told the guy that did the art is a guy named Marcus Greiner, and when we were talking, I just told him, like, I think I would love it if you could just, I have this song, Smoke in the Stars. It's the opener on the record. I said, I'd love it if you could turn that song into a piece of art. And that's what he came up with. Mm. And I thought it was brilliant. And I was in love with it the first moment I saw it. But in the song, I start by, I had this dream that I was standing in this cabin in the middle of like Bakersfield. I don't know how I knew I was in Bakersfield. Not in the middle of Bakersfield, but between Bakersfield and the Grapevine. Like where there's like nothing. You know, you get out of the Grapevine and there's that big open area where you just see the Five run for miles.
Everything's in flames and
yeah,
infested with sea serpents.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But I'm in this cabin, like on the middle of like a plain, middle of a like, you know, plain, like a desert plain. And I'm standing in opaque blue water up to like my knees, and it's dark, but I can see the blue water like perfectly, really weird lighting. And there's snakes swimming around me. And then I see the door. It's totally pitch dark, except the water's lit. And then I see all of a sudden this door, like a light starts shining through the cracks of the door. Mm. And then I woke up. And naturally, I decided to turn it into a love song wherein...
As one does.
Someone comes and opens the door for me. And then the place gets set aflame and the snakes turn into fire. And they just blow up.
That's what, you know, it's what love is.
That's what love is, man. Yeah. Just snakes burning up in a cabin in the middle of Bakersfield. What?
On that note, before we play a song, and since you seem to love poetry, we're going to do a brief writing exercise.
Let's do it.
There is a notebook with a pen down there.
Oh, all right.
And since we've been going strong with Bill Shakespeare here, we're going to write our own poem based on this line. He hath been used ever to conquer... and to have his worth of contradiction. Mm. All right, you want to go first? Or you want me to go first?
You go first. Okay. Actually, no, I'll go first.
Okay.
In case yours just you just knocked it out of the park.
I have no idea.
I'm not going to be the headliner.
Go ahead.
All right. What saith he in times of death when love has time's good deeds in cuffs? What saith he before escape when trouble lies and sorrows wake? In due course he'll conquer love by leaving it to die. In contradiction, by and by, he'll do it with a lie.
Mm. As a baby screams outside
of our
window, what is going on today?
I don't
know. We got landscaping, we got tiny children being abandoned in the driveway. We don't have any small children.
We should check on that. We should make sure they're not actually being abandoned.
Okay, we will in a second.
Yeah, we got poetry
poem.
To do.
Yeah, okay. How he wanted her, even as he hated everything she said. Red lips spitting flames, while teeth bared to crucify him for some unknown future crime. His blood, whose blue rivers trapped by flesh for now until the knife entered, boiled as she asked him for the fourth or fifth time, did you mail the rent check out this week or not?
That's very good. Way better than mine, man. I was just trying to sound English.
Which song would you like to play?
You know, given the theme of our talk has been circled a lot around grief and stuff, I think I'll play Grandfather.
Great.
Yeah.
The last track off the record.
The last track.
All right.
Grandfather, my mind is a blur. It's like I've been here a while, or I've just now arrived. And the water here's nice, and the wind is so fine. Have I been here a while, or did I just arrive? Grandfather, you have not said a word that is so unlike you. But it's clear from your smile you know something so good. Something I don't know, but something I should. But Grandfather, why haven't you said a word? Ooh. father. Your hair has grown back, and you've got a beard. Your wrinkles have gone and your eyes are like iron. I'm watching you smile as I figure this out. This beautiful place we always talked about. Grandfather, I think my mother's here too. Is her suffering through? I am shaking just thinking of seeing her new, freed from that dark room that's held her since youth. Oh, grandfather, tell me my mother's here too. About what they don't have, or mow people down with tour buses in France, or shoot people up when they're just trying to dance. Dear grandson, grab your heart and prepare. Your mother's just over there, and she is singing this song as she braids her black hair, free from death and destruction, decay and despair. She's peaceful and lovely and breathing new air. She's peaceful and lovely and breathing new air.
Yeah. There he goes, Mr. Jason Hawk Harris. You can go to jasonhawkharris.com for his music and his tour dates. He will be playing at Folk Alliance in New Orleans January 23rd, and then playing throughout the South in Jackson, Mississippi, Memphis, Tennessee, Ruston, Louisiana, Austin, Texas, and more. He's playing at South by Southwest in March, so go check him out. And if you head over to thebluegrasssituation.com, you can see Jason Hawk Harris performing Give In on an old LA soundstage, and I really, really urge you to give his new record, Love in the Dark, a chance. It is truly a gem. And even if you don't think you like where modern country music is going these days, this is where modern country music should be going. And Bloodshot Records put that out. And speaking of new records coming out, I'm going to say it one more time. My band Dust Bowl Revival's new record, Is It You, Is It Me, will be coming out January 31st. I'm going to keep shouting it until it happens. Thank you to 30 Tigers for releasing it for us. You know what? If there's one thing this new record is about, it's about facing your fears. The opening track, Dreaming, is about that fear that I'd never really talk about, which is stage fright. Every night you go out there and you kill yourself a little bit to tell your story. But you know what? It's worth it. It's always worth it. Give that song and all the new ones a listen on Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Music, all that good stuff. And you know what? You can find this podcast on Spotify, on Stitcher, on Apple. We're all over the place. Please tell your friends about us. We're going to have some really fun episodes coming up, and then we'll take a little break and be back in April. The show on the road is hosted by me, Zach Lupitan, and produced by the handsome Hawaiian Chris Jacobs with support from the Bluegrass Situation team. If you love the show on the road, please leave us a review or rating over at itunes.com/showontheroad. Tell your friends, and also be sure to check out BGS's ever-growing collection of podcasts up right now on thebluegrasssituation.com. The Show on the Road is a part of the BGS Podcast Network. This is Zach Lupitan. See you on the trail.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.